This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the podcast for December 7th, 2018. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And hi, I'm Peter Terzakian. We've got a number of topics this week. We've got the Alberta government's historical decision to curtail production by 8.7%, so we're going to talk about that. Then on top of that, from a global perspective.
Yeah, big news today, the day we're recording, where OPEC meeting in Vienna, it was gone into overtime and there was some uncertainty if there would be a decision. But late in the meeting, we did get confirmation they're going to make a cut. So we'll talk about that and what it means for the outlook for oil prices.
And also what's going on right now and all the way to December 14 is the COP24 meeting, the climate change meeting in Katowice, Poland. So we're going to give you an update on what's happening there, the goals and some of the issues that they have to deal with. So why don't we kick off with number one, which is the historic decision by the provincial government here in Alberta to cut production by 8.7%. So what's happened?
Well, the impact on price has been immediate. Compared to about a week prior, the outlook for next year based on the futures market for light crude improved by almost $6 a barrel, and the heavy oil differential narrowed by about $8 a barrel. So we saw an immediate improvement. To give you an idea kind of where prices ended up on an absolute basis, we have prices right now that are virtually double the lows we saw over the last month. So
on the light oil side, we saw what? We saw $15 or something?
We saw for light oil, the lows were near $20 a barrel. We're over $40 a barrel US right now for light crudes in Western Canada. For our heavy crudes, Western Canadian Select, we had lows under $15 US a barrel. Today, we're well over $30 a barrel. And so big change very quickly in the price of oil.
And that puts a lot of the producers at least back in the black in terms of a cash flow basis. So they're not hemorrhaging cash for every barrel of oil they produce.
That's right. We had like negative cash flow when we were at those low levels.
Right.
So we're in a much healthier position when it comes to where prices are. Now, there was some uncertainty in terms of the global prices, which we'll talk about with the OPEC cut because we've got some news on that as well. So it's been a great week in terms of news for Western Canadian producers. A lot more stability in the differentials, where they're going to go, as well as the global price.
So just as a recap, the cuts that were implemented by the Alberta government are a near-term effect, right? Probably over the course of the next few months, even though technically they can extend it out to the end of next year.
That's right. The order was to the end of 2019. But what we think is that these large cuts, the 325,000 barrels a day, will probably stick around until the spring.
Right.
At that time, inventory levels will be drawn down to a point where we can have less cuts. And the other thing that's going to happen between now and the spring is more crude by rail movements.
Right.
And so between those two factors, we should start to see cuts, maybe cut down to about 100,000 barrels a day.
So I think what's important also to let our listeners know is that the cuts come into play January 1st of 2019. That is when the producers will have to pull back, but that the prices actually responded almost immediately.
That's right. And they responded for the entire fiscal year of 2019 on the futures curve very quickly. And so, you know, what we're looking at is a much stronger price in 2019 affected by this policy, because there's certainty now that we won't have the glut, the inventory levels won't keep growing. So it makes sense to me that the futures market reflected that right away.
And the futures market, by the way, is the market that producers can sell their product to buyers at future prices. For example, I can contract to sell 1,000 barrels of oil at X dollars in March, another 1,000 in April, another 1,000 in May, et cetera, et cetera. And you can actually lock those prices in today.
That's right. And those prices are then known to the market, that there was a transaction made at that price. And so what we saw was with this news, there was a change in the expectations of future prices, which makes sense because now we know that we won't have oversupply, that we won't be filling the inventory levels.
Right.
And so that has been very positive.
So the near term has been countered and we'll probably see further narrowing, you would expect, as we head into the spring and the drawdown of the inventories until such time as even more railroad capacity, which is being expedited, comes into play summer and fall and beyond of next year.
Yeah, I do think there's room as the inventories go down and rail moves up for differentials to move in a little bit more. So yes, that's possible. And then there's also some medium and long-term things that will be happening when we think about the year.
Mm-hmm.
So by the medium term, more crude by rail. In the long term, we also have this Line 3 replacement project, which will be coming on in the last quarter of 2019, which will add more takeaway capacity and have another positive impact in terms of the market's fundamentals.
Right. So let's just pause a minute and reflect on the sense of scale here. So in Western Canada, we produce in total all types of oils, all the way from the oil sands down to the lights, typically, what, 4.5 million barrels per day?
4.5 million barrels a day of production. Now, that does increase when we want to ship it out of the province because we have to blend it with the lighter products. We have a bit higher supply number.
Okay, but let's call it 4.5. Yeah. The supply-demand imbalance into the pipelines was about 200,000 barrels a day. So what these cuts are doing is chewing into the 200,000 plus another 125 to make 325. And that extra 125 is to draw down the inventories.
That's right. And so the belief is by the spring, we'll have drawn down those inventories. Also, we'll have higher crude by rail movements. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the curtailment might be as low as 100,000 barrels a day as we look into the second half of the year. Not that big.
So, Jackie, talk about that. Like when we say crude by rail, as I call it, it's like a pipeline on wheels, like one unit train. And a unit train is a train completely dedicated to hauling tankers of oil, like what is that, like 110 cars or something like that, right? Well, how much capacity is that in one unit train?
For heavy oil, it's about 60,000 barrels a day per unit train.
Right.
And these are big trains, as you say. They need as many as 3 locomotives to pull them.
Right.
And so to move 60,000 barrels a day, you need one of those moving every single day. And it's about a 20-day return trip to the Gulf Coast.
Right.
So you need a whole fleet of rail cars and trains to do that.
So like Thomas the Tank Engine going around and around on a track.
Yeah, a whole bunch of them.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so that's why, you know, it seems simple, like, oh, get one unit train. How hard can that be? But you have to think about the fact that you need many of them to be able to sustain that every single day.
Right, to make that trip down and back. And so that's 60,000 barrels per day. So notionally, with enough locomotives, you're talking about, say, 4 trains a day, 240,000 barrels to offset the near-term glut that we've had.
That's right. Well, you know, I'm already accounting for some crude by rail in that number already. So we don't have the official numbers right now. The latest data we have is for September, and we were still below 300,000 barrels a day of crude by rail movements out of Western Canada. But we do believe, based on our talking to people in the industry, that we're closer to 400,000 barrels a day at the end of this year. And so what we're talking about is incremental additions on top of that that we'll be adding next year, some from the government, which won't come on until October. But there is actually some near-term increase of crude by rail announced. For example, Imperial talked about increasing their crude by rail in the first quarter of the year. And so we do think that crude by rail will increase going into the new year. That, combined with the cuts, will balance the market.
So let's just project out to the end of next year, 2019. How much is going to be going down south via rail?
Well, I believe with the Alberta government announcements, as well as the other industry announcements, including Imperial and Cenovus, we could be as high as 700,000 barrels a day of crude by rail capacity. I don't know that that will all be used, but that would be the potential.
Well, 700,000, that's all, basically a Keystone XL, isn't it?
It almost is, right? Yeah. You know, in fact, Keystone XL is 830,000 barrels a day, but the original proposals for Keystone XL was that it would only move about 730,000 out of Western Canada because it was going to pick up crudes in the United States as well. So yeah, it's the equivalent of a Keystone XL.
So Keystone XL on wheels coming in 2019. So let's move on to the global oil price, because to this point we've been talking about the difference between the prices that are realized in the Texas Gulf Coast region, and those are affected by the global prices, which had been falling.
That's right. We've seen about a $20 drop in the price of WTI from October until November, and that is because we went from a situation where we thought the market was tight in terms of not enough supply to an oversupplied market. It happened very quickly in the course
it was like
of a month.
In a span of a month, it was amazing, and so the expectations changed from places like Iran.
That's right. One of the biggest catalysts for the change was the Iran situation. So Iran, there was a view that they would reduce their exports almost to nothing because Donald Trump had come out and said that he wanted no exports from Iran. And so that would have been a big hole in the oil markets. That was about 2.5 million barrels a day of exports. The reality is they've dropped by about 1 million barrels a day right now. And then Trump provided waivers, which was a surprise to everyone at the beginning of November, so that countries could continue to get exports from Iran. So now the view is that they're maybe going to stay where they're at, which is only about 1 million barrels a day down from what they were.
So these sanctions were basically very porous. And so that created expectation now of higher supply instead of lower supply. In the background, the Saudis cranked up their production more to backfill for what they thought was going to be a deficit from Iran.
Exactly. Themselves, as well as other OPEC members and Russia, of course. And then on top of that, the United States has grown more than people expected. This is a reoccurring theme.
Yeah, that's just amazing how much they've grown.
Yeah. Nice. So now we went from a view, you know, in September timeframe that we're going to have a very over, you know, undersupplied market, tight market, rising prices, to a glut once again, and actually a very big glut. By the numbers that came out with the IEA's oil market report in November, we would be looking, if there was no OPEC cut, at about 2 million barrels a day too much oil in the market for the first half of 2019. So to put that in perspective, you know, if that were to occur, we would go from very normal inventory levels globally to being right back to where we were at the end of 2016 before OPEC made those cuts. We could have, all things the same, you know, in the range of 300 million barrels a day sitting in storage tanks over what we typically would have.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was not a good looking picture. That's what caused the price to fall
so
fast.
That's 2 million barrel per day surplus. Though, I mean, there was some common belief that a lot of that was due to demand destruction, but that's not really the case.
This is a supply issue. This is not a demand issue.
Oversupply.
Demand has still been strong. We've just got too much crude oil coming from OPEC and Russia and the United States relative to where demand is. And really, because Iran exports aren't dropping off like people thought. And that's really fundamentally what happened here. The level of production would have been okay if we would have saw Iran go to very low export levels.
So the price of oil had basically fallen to the $50 US level in
at WTI,
Texas. Yeah. What happened this morning?
So this morning was, I think at some point, a little bit unexpected, because OPEC met yesterday and couldn't come to a decision about a cut. And that got people really downplaying the fact that there would be a cut, even though one is needed.
When we say they couldn't come to an agreement, I mean, I don't know. I've lost count how many people are in that OPEC plus group, but say, you know, 15 to 20. But really, it's just two countries, Saudi Arabia and Russia.
That's right. The rumors were that Russia could not come to a cut. And if they weren't going to cut, the others would not cut as well. And so it wasn't looking good yesterday in terms of coming to a decision. It went into overtime on Friday, December 7th. Went very late. And then finally, they came to a cut that surprised everyone, actually. 1.2 million barrels a day is bigger than what might have been expected. It's a good number. It will do a lot to help balance the markets next year and bring a lot of stability to oil prices.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Jackie, is that, you know, we've got the three biggest oil producers in the world. Now, number one is United States. Number two is Russia. Number three is Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis and the Russians are the ones that are cutting, and the Americans continue to push more oil into the market. So this really is a big global battle for market share. And the response on the other side of the world, because certainly the Saudis need 60 plus to cover their costs, including their social costs. The Russians like to maximize what they get. And so it's a very interesting dynamic. I think in the near term here, this is good news. The price of oil popped up a bit.
It did. Yeah, we were up about $3 or $4 a barrel with the news. And so that's good, and good news for Canadian producers as well.
Sure. So the top line goes up. I think that there's still uncertainty going forward. I think it's going to be volatile because so much of the situation depends upon these actors, Saudi Arabia, Russia in particular, being able to maintain this alliance on a go-forward basis. And the other wild card is whether or not the United States can continue to surge its production ahead. And there's mixed views on that, whether or not they can do that.
That's right. So, I mean, I think I would agree with you longer term, but when I think about the next 6 months, I think it's very likely that this agreement holds. We get some stability in global prices. Now, the one wild card might be the reaction of President Donald Trump. He's been quite the Scrooge in terms of wanting prices even lower. $50 is not low enough for him. And he even, on the eve of this OPEC meeting, put out a tweet, "Hopefully OPEC will be keeping oil flows as is, not restricted. The world does not want to see or need higher oil prices," he says. But that didn't affect them. They still made the cut. So, you know, the wild card might be his reaction. But I have a feeling they'll stick with this for the short term
anyway. Well, the cuts start driving the price of oil to 80 or 90 bucks. I mean, it drove it to 55, right?
Yeah. Oil price is still relatively low in the history of oil price for the last 5 or 6 years. But I will agree with you. If you think beyond the next 6 months, you think the next year or two, at some point, the strategy is probably going to come into question by OPEC and Russia. It looks like Russia's already starting to waffle a little bit on it in that, you know, they keep cutting to keep the price high. But over time, if the U.S. continues to grow and they don't, it's not going to work for them at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this many times. We're going to talk about it more in future podcasts. The strategy in the situation of macroeconomic uncertainty and externalities like OPEC for domestic producers is to keep innovating, keeping your costs low and being able to make your returns and making it work at $50, $55. I think that that's the threshold. And the good news is that in the absence of differentials, many of these companies were being able to do that.
That's right. And so for Canadian oil and gas producers, oil producers, this week has been quite a change in events here. You know, we've gone from a situation where the differentials were extremely wide, like $40 a barrel. They've been cut in half for heavy oil and cut in half for light oil. But there was still that uncertainty about what was going to go on with the global price because our differentials are still wider than they typically have been. And so if the global price keeps etching down, that's putting a lot of pressure on prices here in Western Canada. And so at least we have some visibility to the next 6 months that we'll get some stability on global prices, a lot less volatility on our differentials. And I think that will give producers here the confidence to spend some money this year, which wouldn't have been the case if we hadn't seen these changes.
Well, I mean, the last few weeks have been borderline existential for the industry with the cash flow negativity and all sorts of other issues. I agree with you. The tone has changed, and that's positive. Shall we move on to the climate change conference meeting in Katowice, Poland, all the way until December 14th? So there's been the speeches, the kickoff last week.
That's right.
And what are some of the themes we're hearing?
Well, the main objectives of this meeting is a deadline for implementing the Paris Agreement. Believe it or not, even though we made these aspirational goals in Paris 3 years ago, there still isn't a plan to implement them. So they're saying actually this is one of the most important meetings since Paris. Mm-hmm. And also there's some other needs like increasing the financing for climate action. So basically for many of these countries that made their commitments to reduce, it was contingent on them getting some money. And they haven't made an agreement for that yet either.
Right.
So people say this one's pretty important if we're going to actually move forward.
So really it's about who's going to pony up the money to do all this, number one. And number two, how are we going to account for the carbon emissions from various countries and hold countries accountable? Is that really the
thing? Yeah, there's another theme there around reporting. And there's some inconsistencies in terms of how countries report. Do they get credits for certain things or not? And in order to hold people accountable, you got to get the numbers all apples to apples. So that's another big initiative at the conference.
Well, there's so much going on, but there's also a change in attitude, I think, that was somewhat notable. David Attenborough, the famous narrator of the BBC Nature series and so on, was one of the lead speakers there. You know, I found it interesting that he made the comment, you know, in this rather dire speech about the end of civilization and so on. But I think, you know, he got it right in a sense that he put the onus back on the individual. And we've talked about this in previous podcasts about battling climate change, because at the end of the day, energy is about the way we live, work, and play. And so we have to change the way we live, work, and play if we're going to change our energy consumption and therefore our emissions. And, you know, just sort of reading from the transcript of his speech, you know, he basically said that collectively making tough decisions, but also willing to make sacrifices in their daily lives, speaking about the citizens of the planet. And, you know, we've talked about that before. The whole idea of, well, making sacrifices in your daily life is something that's related to your comfort and your lifestyle and so on. And so that's really correct. I've argued that long ago in my second book, The End of Energy Obesity, which was published in 2009, 10 years ago. That's the core issue, is that if we are really serious about this whole climate change and reduction of carbon emissions, then we have to make some serious changes to our lifestyle.
Well, and I want to just talk a bit about David Attenborough's comments, because I do think it's important. And, you know, he's like 90 years old, but he's very savvy with social media, because on his release, there was a couple of social media initiatives to try to get better awareness with the general public around what you're saying, that you have to take some onus in your own life.
The bot,
and
right?
So, well, there's a couple of things. There's this hashtag, take your seat, for social media, where he put an actual seat in the UN chamber that says hashtag take your seat, or the people's seat. And basically people are supposed to use social media to share ideas about how to reduce emissions. So there's some things about, you know, flying less, to people saying what you need to do about power plants that aren't fully utilized. I mean, there's about a bunch of discussion going on. So he's trying to generate more discussion in social media. There also a lot of fanfare around this UN Facebook Messenger bot, sounds very high tech, that they've launched, where people are supposed to go online and, you know, use this bot to communicate, and it tells you things you need to do. I guess the sacrifices he talked about to change your lifestyle, things, they don't surprise you. They're not actually big changes. They're things like buy your food locally, bring your own bags to the grocery store, unplug your electronics, recycle. Sure. Big one, meat-free meals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of emissions significant from agriculture, farming, and ranching.
Yeah, the methane emissions from the cows. I had to do some research. It actually doesn't give you the reason for why you should do these things or why you should even unplug your electronics. And it's not interactive. But, you know, things like five-minute showers. So it goes through and you can say if you want to commit to doing a five-minute shower, you can vote for that. I would just say, you know, these are good. It's good to educate people. But when we talk about these massive goals we have, we're talking about a decline in our greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2030 if we're going to get on this 1.5 degree track, which is something that was talked about by the keynote speakers. It's no longer a 2 degree track. It's a 1.5. And we talked about that influential study that came out around that. It's going to take a bit more than this.
It's going to take a lot more than this. It's going to take, I think the list of things on this bot, what's it called? Act Now bot. I mean, these are all virtuous. I mean, frankly, I'm of the generation where my parents taught me to do pretty much everything on this list. And as the world became more industrialized in 70s, 80s, 90s, and then China began to industrialize and the emerging economies and so on, I mean, a lot of this stuff led to comforts that were really in excess of what the sustainability of the planet can handle. And so the message here, frankly, I think is very virtuous, which is, okay, we got to consume less, but that's not enough. And the question is, how do you trade off comfort? Are you willing to pay more on top of reducing your comfort?
Because, well, and that's the interesting thing, right? Because although these voluntary actions can work for a while, I think we've all tried them, it's tough to stick with them. But if the cost of energy goes up, you're much more motivated to start saving energy. And so interestingly enough, the same week that the COP got set going, we had a very high profile situation here in Paris around some fuel increases. They were going to increase the price of gasoline. And there were very violent riots.
So the yellow jacket, they call them, the yellow vests.
Yes, and they wear these yellow vests to symbolize motorists in distress. But I guess these protests became broader, just protesting the cost of living in general. But they definitely kicked off. The situation was that France already had a carbon tax, but it was set to increase more in 2019. Now, I went and looked this up, put in Canadian dollar terms. The average price in Paris for a liter of gasoline is $2.30 Canadian, where we pay closer to a dollar a liter here in Alberta.
So it's over double.
Yeah. And what they were talking about was increasing it by 10 cents a liter from where it is today. So interesting that a 10 cent a liter increase could create that type of reaction.
Yeah, it's interesting. But the thing that I think that is not well recognized is that the people that are protesting are on behalf of people that have their personal disposable income completely maxed out. Like, they live from paycheck to paycheck. And if you live in an expensive city like Paris or London or any of these other big cities where it's very, very costly to live, it doesn't take very much of a rise in anything, whether it's gasoline, milk, or some other commodity that is used every day, to throw people over the edge. And I think this shows the complications of the current situation about sacrificing comfort and paying more, right? Now, some would argue, well, okay, swapping out a car and walking, et cetera, as the bot suggests, okay, fine. But I think the reality is that the bulk of the world is not affluent, and the bulk of the world is now being called upon to participate in cutting back on the limited comforts that many of them have and pay more. And so this whole issue of addressing this climate, very serious problem, it's hard.
And I want to add, this isn't just people in Paris. And it is kind of surprising. You know, we all sit here in North America thinking people in Europe, they drive small cars, they care about the environment, they have a carbon tax that's double ours after all. So it's surprising to see this kind of pushback to higher energy prices when they're used to high energy prices. But Brazil, earlier this year, had a similar issue where they increased the price of diesel by 20%, mostly because of the rising global prices. And what you had was semi-drivers blocking roads in the country. And eventually, the government gave in to these protests and initiated subsidies that restored the diesel prices back to where they are. So the message here is, to meet the Paris goals, it looks pretty daunting. You know, these people at COP are designing, what the policy should be to reduce the use of fossil fuels, which generally the real solution is increasing the price of them. But are they going to be able to actually implement them in their countries because people don't want to pay more?
As I said, it's very difficult. I mean, you're asking, as I said, the bulk of the citizenry, I'll call it, in many of these places, they already live in a 200 square foot apartment, and you're asking them to do all these things on the bot, which are already heavily constraining their personal comfort, and you're asking them to pay more. This is really an exercise in behavioral economics and understanding the plight of the bulk of the world in the context of, you know, people who are generally very affluent who are making these policy decisions. And I think that there's a real mismatch between the two. And so really, it all boils down to solutions that are more technology oriented.
Yeah, you can get kind of depressed looking at the situation and what can be done. I think it comes back to, can we find technologies that are better and cheaper and so compelling that we don't want to use fossil fuels? And could we put all our efforts into that? And there are some exciting things going on. Every time I feel this way, I go look at Bill Gates's Breakthrough Energy Fund, and I start to feel a little bit better. I mean, they're talking about companies that he's backing today, or that group is backing, that are going to make way more efficient batteries for electric cars, better batteries for pairing with renewables, geothermal that can actually compete. They're even talking about fusion energy. I mean, that would be a game changer. And things like alternatives to nitrogen fertilizers. Anyway, the list goes on. There's stuff being developed that's game changing that would be competitive, not even just competitive. It would be so much cheaper and so much more compelling that people would switch and not be uncomfortable. Yep. They would switch to something that's better and cheaper. Now, eventually, these things can take a couple of decades develop.
Well, they're going to take more, I guarantee it. But the trajectory is in the right place. And the emphasis has to be on these sorts of technologies, because as I like to review the history and the evolution of energy transitions and so on, I like to tell people, nobody put a carbon tax on the kerosene lantern. Nobody put a carbon tax on the horse. I mean, we did transition into electric lighting, and we did transition into motor cars. The thing, though, is that it still takes time. And what we have in the world today is a situation where we have seven and a half billion people who are entrenched in a current way, in a current economic circumstance. So the transition to these new technologies is necessary, but it's going to take a few decades. But the investments that are made today are hopefully going to accelerate that adoption curve. And at the end of the day, fiscal tools like carbon taxes and others, which we're seeing are very contentious, hopefully won't be necessary, because new technologies will be introduced that offer better utility at lower price.
Right. And if all this financing and effort that's going into COP and all these things could go towards accelerating the timelines for some of these technologies, that would be a real win.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. We want to thank you for tuning into this podcast. If you like it, please like us on iTunes or your other platform and tell someone else about us. We had quite a few people do that in the last week, and we really appreciated that.
We sure do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.